Hello and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, episode 125. I'm your host, The Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is this week's special guest co-host, CJ Chris Johnston.
Thanks for having me back on Power Pros, Chris.
My pleasure. Glad to have you back. We are, of course, back once again to talk about what's going on in the world of Nintendo. We've got some new releases to talk about, as well as some news to discuss. And then we've got this week's big topic, which is going to be our favorite gaming couples. It's sort of a counterpoint to last week's favorite gaming nemesis. But we'll get to that in a little bit. Before we do so, we will start things off by discussing an upcoming game for the Nintendo 3DS, of all things.
All right.
It is Radiant Historia Perfect Chronology. This is a role-playing game from Atlus. It is a remake of a title that originally came out on the Nintendo DS system, and there is a demo available out now in the Nintendo 3DS eShop. CJ, are you familiar with this game at all? Did you happen to play it on DS? Are you looking forward to it?
I know absolutely nothing about this series, although I have heard it spoken about by RPG fans.
Well, it is very, very good. You know, I played all the way through it back on the DS, and I enjoyed it tremendously. I didn't do 100% of everything in the game. You know, I was playing it for review, and I always intended to go back to it and finish off the little extra story bits that I had never seen, but it just never happened. So I've been really looking forward to getting this version of the game and finally experience every little thing that's in there. And not only does it have everything that was in the DS version, but there's also new story content and other new elements as well, such as you can choose from three difficulty settings. There's normal, hard, and then a casual mode where there are hardly any battles to engage in. And then you can choose from two gameplay modes, perfect mode and append mode. Perfect mode integrates the new content into the main story, whereas append mode only lets you access this new content after you've beaten the main game. So perfect is sort of meant to be for players already familiar with the story, and append is meant for newcomers.
That's pretty handy. I like that approach to this.
Yeah, it's nice to have all that stuff. And it's all there in the demo. This demo, you know, is pretty fully featured. I've been playing the demo for more than an hour, and I haven't reached the end of it yet. But yeah, all the options are there. I chose to play in normal mode, and then I went for the perfect mode, which has the new content in there. You know, it's been like, you know, 6 years or more since I played the DS game, so I don't remember it that well, but I have played it, and I sort of liked the experience to be, you know, somewhat different and enhanced, so that's what I'm going with. I'm going to just have all that new stuff integrated right in.
Now, if this demo is so long, does it let you transfer your save data over, or is it just a standalone thing?
No, it does indeed let you transfer your save data over, and apparently you get some bonus items just for playing the demo, and they will transfer over into the full game as well. Yep.
Awesome.
So a few things struck me right off the bat about this game. First of all, it looks very much like the old DS game. They haven't done anything to the graphics at all, as far as I can tell. It's just in widescreen. And it's not even in 3D. There's no stereoscopic 3D effects. So that was kind of a bummer. I was kind of hoping that it would have stereoscopic 3D, because I like that feature. It also does have some new illustration scenes, some minor additional story elements so far. Obviously, there's a lot more story elements that I just haven't encountered in this first hour of gameplay. And then there are also new voiceovers, which I don't think were in the original.
Is the game in English with voice acting, or is it in Japanese?
Oh, no, it's all English voice acting.
Oh, okay, great.
It's somewhat of a mixed bag so far. A lot of the characters don't quite sound like I would have expected them to, but, you know, I'm kind of glad it's in there nonetheless.
Cool.
Anyway, if you have not played this game at all, I guess what you should know is you play as a main character named Stock. He is a military secret agent, and he is joined by two subordinates, Rainey and Marco. And they're caught up in the middle of this conflict between their country and another country. Initially, your goal is to go out and rescue this ally agent. He's been spying in the other country. He has vital information. He will, you know, turn the war in your favor if you can rescue him. And, you know, that's how the story begins. However, you also, you know, gain possession of this book called The White Chronicle. And, you know, just as you're about to go out on this mission, you have this vision. Stock has this vision that Rainey and Marco are dead. And he's like, oh, well, that's weird. I'm going to just try to put that out of my head and go rescue this guy. And as you play through the mission, you know, you find the agent, you're trying to get him back alive, but then you're ambushed. And just like in his vision, Randy and Marco die, the agent dies, and, you know, everything goes to heck. But then, you know, as you you jump over this bridge, you are trying to escape with your life, you know, from these really tough enemies. The White Chronicle, you know, like awakens its power, and you get to travel back in time. You gain the ability to travel back in time to key moments, so you get to go back to where you made the decision to take a certain route as you're trying to escape, from the enemies. And you relive this moment. So instead of going north, you go south, you make a different choice, and then it's like, okay, well, this time we made the other choice, and we survived, and everyone got through alive.
Hmm.
And that's kind of what this game is all about. As you play through the game, you have these choices at key points in the game, and that affects how the story unfolds. Like, the next one that comes up is you get to choose, do you want to continue serving under your current commander, or do you want to join your best friend's brigade? And, you know, not to spoil too much, but, you know, either choice you make, you will sort of run into a dead end eventually. But by traveling back to these key points in time, trying the alternate choice, and, you know, learning different things from each path, you'll eventually find a way forward. And that's what the game is all about. It's a time travel game. You know, it's not exactly like Chrono Trigger, but it does have, you know, some very similar themes, obviously. Traveling back through time and trying to, you know, reach the perfect, correct future.
Very cool.
Yeah, I like it quite a bit. The demo tells me that the 3DS version is not quite as enhanced an upgrade as I was hoping for, but I was, you know, sucked back in immediately by the story, by the characters, and just the whole time-hopping gameplay. You know, I know a lot of people have moved on to Switch and have given up on the 3DS already, but, you know, if you're into RPGs and you did not play this on the DS, I would definitely recommend checking it out. At least check out the demo.
Is the combat system more action-oriented, or is it turn-based, or what kind of system?
I'm happy you asked, because the combat system is very interesting. It's a turn-based system, but the way it works is that the enemies are on this 3x3 grid, and what you're encouraged to do is to use these special moves that sort of knock the enemies into each other. So you sort of pile them all up into, you know, a single square on the grid, and then one attack, you know, hits all the enemies.
Huh.
And so you sort of knock them back, knock them to the side. But yeah, your goal is to cluster them all together and then execute moves that hit them, you know, all at once. And it's a pretty cool and fun system. Yeah, it's not really like anything else out there. I mean, there are certainly other games that have grid-based combat, but in this case, it's not for your characters. It's just for the enemies, and it's just so you can cluster them together and unleash these big combos. It's definitely fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so the full game comes out next week. I'm definitely going to pick that up, and I look forward to continuing my adventure then. I don't suppose you're planning to pick this one up?
I'm one of those people that you described who are not going back to the 3DS anytime soon. So for me, it's a pass.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a shame. But yeah, I mean, maybe you should pick up the demo anyway. Just give it a spin. It doesn't cost you a thing.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. I might do that.
Well, on the other hand, is there anything that you have been playing on Switch?
I have. I've been playing a little game from Choice Provisions called Space Dave.
Ah, okay. That's the sequel to Woe Dave, right?
It is indeed. Woe Dave, of course, came to a lot of different platforms, and it was an old-school shooter. The sequel, Space Dave, is also an old-school retro-style shooter. It's kind of akin to your Galaga or your Space Invaders.
Oh, okay.
You select a character from the various Daves that the game presents you with, and you are given waves of enemies that you have to shoot down and interact with. And I am terrible at this game. I am absolutely awful. I was also awful at Woe Dave, so it should really come as no shock to anyone about that. But I do really like the graphics. They're very lo-fi, and the waves of enemies that you have to shoot down are very reminiscent of Space Invaders and Galaga, which are two games that I love. And you do have side-to-side motion, just like in those games, and you can also do a jump move. So
interesting.
There's shooting and jumping, and those are mapped to either the face buttons or also the triggers. And I kind of find that playing with the triggers makes it a little bit easier. but I'm, of course, terrible, as I just mentioned. And you can jump over enemy shots, and you can throw enemies, and there's all kinds of different things happening. I need somebody to create a strategy guide, or at least I need to watch a couple of videos to see what people actually do to start the game, because I feel like I'm playing on the easiest difficulty, and I'm getting wrecked, or my scores are not good. So I know I'm doing something wrong. I don't know what, but it's still a fun little game. And it's, I think it's only like $10 on the eShop. It's not an expensive title.
That's cool.
But if you enjoy retro shooters like Galaga and Space Invaders, you might want to give this one a look. Hopefully you will be better at it than I am.
Well, I have to admit, I have not played Woe Dave. I have not played Space Dave. But I do know that, you know, Choice Provisions, they are known for making some very hard games. Mm-hmm. You know, they were known as Gaijin Games when they made the Bit Trip series. But those games were definitely tough. So I wouldn't be surprised if this game is just hard as nails.
Oh, it is. It really is.
All right, cool. Thanks for sharing your impressions on that. Okay, let's move along now to some Nintendo-related news. First of all, the folks at developer CyberConnect 2 have announced a trio of Switch titles. CyberConnect 2, of course, is a studio that, you know, I'm most familiar with for the Dot Hack series, mm-hmm. as well as the Tail Concerto games, those being Tail Concerto, which was a PS1 game, and then its sequel of sorts, Solita Robo, which came out on the Nintendo DS. CJ, have you been following this news about these upcoming titles?
I have not, but I love CyberConnect 2. I love the Dot Hack series, and they did a couple different licensed games too, right? Like Naruto and Dragon Ball, I think, in the past. Yeah, they're a great developer.
Yeah, they are. And this trio of titles they've announced sounds very, very interesting. The first one is tentatively called Fuga on the Battlefield, which is an action strategy RPG set in the same universe as Tail Concerto and Solita Robo, which means lots and lots of furry creatures. Yes, the furry fans are going to love this one. You know, there's cat people and there's dog people. But the story in this one revolves around these 11 orphan kids who are out to get revenge on the evil Burman Empire using this giant tank. And it's armed with this ultimate weapon called the Soul Cannon that is powered by taking a crew member's life. So even though it's all cute and fuzzy, it's like really dark, you know?
That is really dark. Wow. Unexpected.
Yeah, it's about as dark as it gets.
Hmm.
And they haven't really shown anything with the gameplay. They've just shown some concept sketches and then this drawing of this giant tank and, you know, these orphaned, you know, cat and dog people. But I'm very intrigued. I love the previous games set in this universe. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing where this thing goes. One of the other games they announced is called Tokyo Ogre Gate, which they describe as a high-speed parkour-style slashing action game. You play as this sword-wielding schoolgirl, Japanese schoolgirl, named Tawako Mutsa, who got like a heart transplant from something called an ogre engine. And so now she's like the sword-wielding maniac who's out to destroy all the ogre gates that connect the regular world to hell and, you know, then defeat all the bad guys.
Wow.
Again, that one's going a little bit dark.
just a tad bit dark, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And continuing that theme, their third title announced is called Cecile, not to be confused with the recently released Celeste. This is a 2.5D side-scrolling, ultra-fun witch action game. That's what they call it. And it's got this whole, you know, gothic Lolita thing going on. There are these four sisters, and their mother performs some ritual on them that turns them into witches, but also takes away that which they cherish most. That's what it says. So you play as one of these girls, Cecile, and she has lost her singing voice, but now she has a sword and a transforming umbrella, and they promise to have lots of hack and slash action and magic and all kinds of weird things going on with this transforming umbrella weapon. It looks nuts.
That's awesome. I don't know if you remember the Cotton games back in the day, but I'm totally...
I remember the name, but that's about all I remember.
Totally down for some witch combat action. That sounds fun.
Yeah, the thing I wonder about is that, you know, both Cecile and Tokyo Ogre Gate sound very, very similar in that, you know, they seem to be, you know, hack and slash type games. But regardless of that, it's very, very intriguing. I'm glad to see this studio doing a bunch of new original games, and I'm glad to see them all coming to Switch.
Yeah, me too. This is great.
Of these three, which one would you say you are most looking forward to? For me, it's definitely the Fuga on the Battlefield title.
I'd probably say Cecile.
Okay. All right.
Just from the description.
Well, it seems to be the furthest along. It's the only one that they've shown any, you know, real screenshot-looking imagery from. And again, it's still kind of hard to tell. It just looks like, you know, a bunch of crazy slashing and combat going on. But yeah, it looks like fun. It should be cool.
Awesome.
Oh, but hey, speaking of furries, there is another game that came to my attention recently that's on its way to Switch. It's a title called Fox and Forests, which is this indie game from a studio called Bonus Level Entertainment. It is coming out in the spring of this year. Are you familiar with this one?
I was not until I saw the outline for the show, and then I watched the trailer, and it looks awesome. Looks like a nice throwback to 16-bit platforming action games.
Yes, I believe that is exactly what they intend it to be. And it was a Kickstarter title from a while back, but it didn't come to my attention until just recently when they announced it for Switch and showed off this new trailer. And yeah, it totally looks like a throwback to the days of the Super NES. You play as this character named Rick the Fox. You know, he's a humanoid fox, and he's armed with what they are calling a melee crossbow, used for both slashing and shooting. And the big hook to the game, aside from, you know, just, hacking and shooting up lots of enemies, is that you can change seasons with the press of a button. And that affects the environment. So, you know, suddenly you can make it winter and then water freezes. So you can, you know, maybe there was a lake in your way, but now you can just walk right over that lake. Or maybe you can make it turn into autumn and then these big leaves are falling and you can use them as platforms. Or you can make it become spring and then, you know, plants will grow and you can use those to your advantage. And all that stuff seems pretty darn cool.
Yeah, the graphic style looks really interesting too. And yeah, like you said, it looks like Super Nintendo era graphics, and they've definitely captured the spirit of platforming games from that era. I noticed the little zip line. There's a zip line in the trailer that the fox goes down. And yeah, I remember that from many a platformer back in the day.
Yep. According to the press release, the game was indeed inspired by many 16-bit classics. Two of them specifically mentioned are Super Ghouls and Ghosts and ActRaiser 2. And so while the game, you know, looks fantastic, I do find this a little bit worrisome because, for one thing, both of those games are next to impossible.
Yeah.
They are really, really hard. And so I'm worried this game is going to, you know, be like, you know, super duper difficult, as in, you know, I'll only get through the first two stages and then never be able to get any further.
Right, right. You hope that they're just referencing the nostalgia for those games and not actually the difficulty of them.
Yeah, and ActRaiser 2 is also a troublesome one to mention, because that game kind of just sucked.
Yeah.
ActRaiser 1, fantastic. ActRaiser 2 was really hard because the controls were just so clunky and cumbersome. But, you know, if it was inspired in more of a graphical way or something rather than the wonky controls, you know, that's still just fine by me.
Okay.
Yeah, regardless of that, the game looks fantastic, and you know, I'm very, very interested in it. I can't wait to hear what people say about it. Hopefully it's not impossible, because it looks really, really fun. And speaking of cool indie games, also, just a couple days ago, the folks at Rising Star Games announced that SteamWorld Dig 2 is coming out in physical retail form.
Nice.
CJ, did you play this game originally? Did you play the digital version? Are you a big SteamWorld fan?
I am a big SteamWorld fan, yes. Love Dig 1 and 2 and Heist, and I already bought Dig 2 digitally, so I won't be in on the physical version. But this is great news for those who like their game cards physical.
Yeah, I never actually got around to picking this one up, but I did really enjoy the original SteamWorld Dig, so this could be a perfect opportunity for me to add this one to my library.
Oh yeah, the sequel is even better than the original.
Yeah, I definitely heard good things, but yeah, that's good to know. Good to know indeed. That's all I've got in the news this week. Let's move over and answer a little bit of listener mail. This week's listener letter comes from listener Brian Booth, and he writes, "Really enjoyed the latest show. Not sure if it was intentional, but it was nice to have a longer than usual episode after the 1 week hiatus. The topic was really interesting, too. I suppose my favorite video game nemesis is still Knuckles. He was just a great foil to Sonic in so many ways, and he makes Shadow seem like a mostly unnecessary knockoff. I'm still holding out hope that maybe one day he'll make his way into Smash Brothers. Also, you can't neglect the classics, both retro, like Proto Man, and modern, like Shovel Knight's Black Knight. In the vein of rivalry, I'd love to hear your favorite third-party game mascots, those rivals to the likes of Mario, Link, Kirby, Donkey Kong, and Samus from other companies. Maybe you could list your top five favorites, and then maybe one or two that you love to hate. Okay, so where to start responding to this one? Thanks for the kind words, Brian. I wouldn't say it was actually intentional that last week's episode was longer than usual, but, you know, every time we take a week off, it means there's just more stuff to talk about, so that does tend to happen. Regarding Knuckles, he's definitely a great character. I like him quite a bit. The reason he did not make my personal list of favorite nemeses and rivals is just because, you know, he was a great rival the first time he showed up in Sonic 3. But then after that, to me, he just sort of became, you know, another one of Sonic's regular allies. So I don't tend to think of him as that much of a rival to Sonic anymore.
More Mecha Sonic, right?
Metal Sonic?
And he's been a rival in multiple Sonic games.
Yeah, you could consider it to be Metal Sonic. You could consider it to be Shadow. I mean, there is an argument to be made for Knuckles, but like I said, he doesn't really seem to be much of a rival these days.
True.
For me, I would have said, you know, that Sonic's nemesis would just be Eggman himself, but he's just been too nasty in the latest games to even count as a rival type character. So for me, I wouldn't say that was one of my favorites. For that reason alone. Proto Man sort of falls into the same thing. You fought against him, several times when he first appeared in Mega Man 3. But after that, he just sort of became an ally. So yes, those guys were good rivals / nemeses in their first appearances, but that kind of cooled down in the subsequent titles. But still, I don't blame you for picking those as among your favorites. Shovel Knight, Black Knight, though, is a great choice. That one is a really neat rivalry in that game.
True.
As for the question about favorite third-party mascots, boy, that's kind of tricky. I mean, what characters even count as mascots?
Rayman.
Oh, that's a good one. That's definitely a good one. Yeah.
Don't forget him. Yeah. I thought about this question a little bit, and I don't know. Do you count Rare characters as third party now that they're not associated with Nintendo?
Maybe. I mean, for me, the question is like, what is a mascot? You know, usually a mascot's like, the one character that's like the icon for your company.
That's true.
But not everyone thinks of it that way. You know, a lot of times, just if you're just talking about, mascot style characters, that's a completely different thing. So I think it's fine to answer the question that way. But yes, I mean, these days, all the Rare characters like Banjo, they are definitely third party or.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's first-party competition, so in the spirit of rivalry, it definitely counts.
Conker?
Yeah, Conker's a fun one, too. I mean, for me, obviously, I would say characters like Sonic, Mega Man, that would be very obvious.
Sure.
What about, over at Konami? They used to be one of my favorite companies. I wouldn't really say that Simon Belmont is a mascot or anything.
No.
But, at one time, certainly, he could have hung with the best of classic gaming characters,
indeed.
He would fit right in with Mario and Link, or perhaps more accurately with Kid Icarus and Mega Man, as they go about adventures in Video Land, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, totally. What about Goemon for Konami?
Oh yeah, that's close to a mascot character, if anything is.
Although he hasn't really been around recently.
No, they pretty much killed him off, but he's a great character.
And if you want to count Hudson, now that they're owned by Konami, you can mention Bomberman.
Yeah, Bomberman, as well as Master Higgins.
Oh, yeah. Either one of them
would be pretty good.
Indeed.
Although I have to say, probably one of my favorites, and this is definitely someone who I would say is a rival because it's not on Nintendo systems, but over on PlayStation, Ratchet and Clank.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I mean, they're definitely some of my favorite characters in that vein. And, out of like all the characters that have never appeared on Nintendo system, I feel like, that's the one that most should be there. It feels like such a Nintendo-y property. And I say that with, all respect to the folks at Insomniac. They have made characters that are comparable to the best of the best. So,
completely.
Yeah, that would be near the top of my list.
I completely agree.
Were there any other ones that you wanted to mention?
Well, going back to Ubisoft, you got Rocket Robot on Wheels from the N64. not quite a mascot, but a great game from Sucker Punch, who would later go on to develop Infamous and all of those other games for Sony.
A little Sly Cooper, you know.
It's, so that's yeah,
a mascot Sly Cooper. Character right there.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, indeed. To stay on Sega for a second, Toe Jam and Earl.
Yeah.
Those back in the day, those guys were secondary mascots to Sonic, but they were on there.
Yeah, Naito's a good one too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's all I can think of. Although, thinking about Sega, maybe Billy Hatcher.
I love that game. I don't know if I love that character. But
I thought the game was okay, but I had a t-shirt with Billy Hatcher on it for a long time, and I loved that shirt.
Wow. When you put it on, you start feeling cocky.
That's right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Parappa the Rapper. That's another one. It's another one.
Yeah, but that's not Nintendo. I mean,
No, it's not. It's definitely not. Like I said, he's talking about rivals to the Nintendo guys.
Oh.
So, yeah, when you're talking about other companies, Ratchet and Parappa from over in Camp Sony would be among my faves. As for ones that I love to hate, boy, I don't know. That one's really tricky, too.
Mm.
I don't really give them that much thought. I guess I'll have to say KO the Kangaroo just because there was an issue of Nintendo Power where I drew a picture of him having died from stab wounds, which is probably the most inappropriate thing that management ever let us get away with.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
There's always Bubsy.
Yeah, yeah. He's like a punching bag, man. That's true. Almost doesn't seem fair.
That's true.
But yeah, those games were not the best.
No.
Sorry, Bubsy. Sorry, little kangaroo guy. All right. Well, that takes care of this week's mailbag. Let's take an intermission, and then we come back. We'll discuss this week's big topic, which is our favorite gaming couples. All right, we are back and we are ready to discuss this week's big topic, which is our favorite video game couples. You know, last week we did our favorite gaming nemeses and rivalries, so we thought a good counterpoint to that would be our favorite gaming couples. Plus, it's Valentine's Day next week, so I thought, what better time to be discussing video game romances?
There is clearly no better time.
That's right. And just like last week's discussion, there definitely will be spoilers, so be warned, spoilers aplenty are coming. So there are, of course, lots of video game romances we could talk about, but I feel like, you know, one of the ones that comes up a lot and, you know, has a lot of room for debate over, you know, the best relationships in the game would be the Legend of Zelda series.
Hmm.
And there are lots of different characters who, you know, you possibly could say are Link's romantic interest throughout the series. Obviously, there is Princess Zelda herself. There is Tetra in The Wind Waker. There's also Ilya in Twilight Princess. CJ, who would you say is Link's best match throughout the Zelda series?
Mipha, of course.
Mipha. The Zora Fishwoman.
Yes, I have really no reason to select Mipha other than I thought she was a great character and her power in Breath of the Wild is very nice.
Well, I have to say, I completely and totally agree with you. It's one of the few relationships where they actually really delve into it in the game and make it seem kind of believable, like these characters actually have a history together.
Yeah.
I mean, they do so with Ilya as well. You can tell there's some history with her and Link, but I think it's done way better with Mipha And, you know, the thing is that you can't really tell how Link is reacting. He doesn't say too much in these scenes. But, you know, the way that Mipha comes across, it makes me feel like their relationship is true and believable. A lot of people point to the relationship between Link and Princess Rudo in Ocarina of Time, and they say, oh, well, you know, this relationship really isn't much different from that. Remember, they claimed they were going to get married, blah, blah, blah. But in that game, you know, that was sort of made in jest. They had just met. They were children. They got the Zora pendant, which they claim is, you know, a sign of, you know, that the fact they're going to get married someday. But there was clearly no relationship there. Hmm. While with Mipha in Breath of the Wild, you know, it's brought up time and time again. They had known each other for a long time. You know, when you talk to Mipha's brother, Prince Sidon, you know, he mentions, oh, there was some young swordsman who kept coming by and visiting my sister and spending all this time with her. I mean, that, more than anything, makes it clear that, you know, they really did, you know, have a relationship going on.
Yeah.
You know, then he even talks about how he could have actually been, you know, his brother-in-law. So, you know, I don't think this is just a case of Mipha having some, you know, puppy love type of crush on Link that, you know, is very one-sided. I think the other characters would probably know that and recognize it and treat it as some sort of unrequited romance, but that doesn't seem to be the case, despite the fact that, you know, Link himself is fairly stoic throughout everything that's going on.
That's true. That's true.
So, yes, I totally agree and also say that the Link-Mipha relationship is my favorite in the Zelda series.
Mm.
As for Link and Zelda, you know, that seems like maybe the obvious choice to make, but for me, that always seems kind of iffy because we've got the bloodline of the princess and then the bloodline of the hero. And so, like, if they ever got together, that would just make things very, you know, sort of uncomfortable, you know, if it's supposed to be the progeny of both of them that are meeting up in later games. That's not always the progeny. I know that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that Wind Waker Link is necessarily related by blood to the previous Links. Or maybe he is. I don't know. They don't really go into that. But sometimes they definitely are, which would make things very awkward. And I think that's why they never really have Link and Zelda get together for the most part and have these additional romantic interests instead.
Yeah. Isn't it sort of hinted at in Skyward Sword?
In Skyward Sword.
That at least Zelda really likes Link.
That one, you know, more than all the rest, it really does seem like they're going to get together. And, you know, she is pretty much the romantic interest in that game.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, in that case, it does make a lot of sense. And then, of course, there's the ending to Zelda 2, where they seem to be, you know, making out as the curtain drops. So, you know, certainly the romance is there in some of the titles, but a lot of times it just seems like it's, you know, problematic as far as, you know, the character's genealogy goes.
Right, right. And in Breath of the Wild, it doesn't seem like Zelda really has much of a romantic flame for Link.
No, not too much.
No.
Speaking of The Legend of Zelda, though, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the Yeti couple from Twilight Princess is certainly one of my favorite gaming couples.
Absolutely. That whole section of that game was fantastic.
It was fantastic and weird and funny. Mm-hmm. And there's the big Yeti, like, going to, you know, these great lengths to try to take care of his wife. And then, you know, she turns evil. And, you know, then, you know, the whole fight's in their bedroom. It's hilarious. And then I think, you know, after the fight is over, they get together and, like, all these hearts burst out of them and, like, fall onto the floor for you to collect. So, yeah. I think they're definitely the hottest couple in the Zelda series. They put Link and Mipha to shame for sure.
Definitely true. Yes.
Okay, so moving on from The Legend of Zelda to, you know, Nintendo's, you know, other huge series, the Mario series, what about that game? I mean, are we just going to stick to Mario and Princess Peach as being the de facto greatest Nintendo couple? What are your thoughts, CJ?
I don't know. I think, you know, obviously in gaming, Princess Peach has been there for Mario, but there's also, you know, Pauline and Daisy, and there's a lot of different options for Mario, I would say.
Well, I mean, in a sense, you're right, but in another sense, I would say that Mario's love life has definitely taken a negative turn recently.
Hmm.
I mean, in Super Mario Odyssey, Mario meets up with Pauline, and she acts like she doesn't even know him.
That's
like,
true.
Who are you, basically? You know, she completely ignores their past history. I mean, meanwhile, she's probably just thinking like, oh, that dreamy gorilla.
But they shared all of those hearts once, you know, Mario climbed up the scaffolding or whatever. In all of those Donkey Kong levels, she's just going to throw that away?
Well, I mean, once upon a time, you know, that's what she was into, but now, not so much. Hmm. And then, of course, we were talking about, you know, Princess Peach here, and at the end of the game...
Spoiler. Spoilers.
Yes, these are definitely some of the spoilers I was talking about. You know, so you go through all this stuff, you travel literally around the world to get her back, and you defeat Bowser, and then, you know, you're kind of arguing with Bowser over who gets the girl, and she's kind of like, hey, I am not just some, you know, woman to be fought over. I'm my own person. I make my own decisions. And she just flies off and leaves Mario behind.
That's right.
And while I certainly, you know, can agree with her from a certain point, I mean... couldn't she have like come to that conclusion before he went all the way around the world to try to rescue her? I mean, that just seemed so cold, man.
Well, I took it also as she wanted to venture out on her own and see the world, and then she would make a choice of who she wanted to be with.
So she did. She is currently traveling, not on her own, with her lady friend, her Tiara.
Yeah, that's right.
And so they are exploring the world at the end of Super Mario Odyssey. But, Mario and Bowser were just left there holding their wilted flowers, if you know what I mean.
That's right.
So, you know, in the Mario universe, you know, right now, these days, I would not be able to call the Mario-Peach relationship one of my favorite relationships. I'm not even sure how healthy that relationship is.
True.
But, you know, the long... rumored, secretly burning, passionate relationship in the Mushroom Kingdom is Luigi and Princess Daisy.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's not something you see on the game screen very often. You know, I remember there was like a statue of the two of them in, some Mario Kart game. And, they were great partners in Double Dash.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, you don't see it. But still, for me... you know, I think that is one of the great gaming relationships.
I never thought about that one before, but I think you're right.
And, you know, it was established way back 25 years ago in the Super Mario Brothers movie. Who got Princess Daisy in that live-action film? It wasn't Mario, it was Luigi.
Oh.
So, even though that movie is mostly forgotten by Nintendo, I do feel like it lives on just a little bit in this quietly smoldering relationship.
I think that's canon. It's going to have to be addressed in the Super Mario movie that Illumination's doing, of course.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, hopefully so. Are there any other relationships in the Mario universe that you're particularly partial towards?
I would say Captain Toad and Toadette.
Oh, well, I didn't even realize they were an item.
I don't know if they are, but certainly he went through all that trouble to rescue Toadette.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Well, they certainly should be an item.
And then Toadette went through all that trouble to rescue Captain Toad herself, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that certainly sounds like the good, solid basis for a relationship to me.
Indeed.
I will certainly take that answer. Sounds good to me.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to go to Xenoblade Chronicles 2, you could mention Tora and Poppy, or Rex and Pyra.
Uh-huh. You know, I haven't finished that game yet. Certainly I can tell that Tora has a huge crush on his robot friend.
Mm-hmm.
So far, Rex is kind of denying any romantic interest in Pyra. You know, he's like, oh no, you got it all wrong.
He denies, but I think he doth protest too much.
I mean, he did have to go to all the trouble of introducing them to his parents.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as my playthrough goes, I guess I'm just going to have to wait and see. But I remember there was some comment about, the drivers and the blades sometimes getting married. So, perhaps that's how it's all going to end up.
Maybe. I have not finished it either, so I don't know.
is it legal for Tora to marry a robot? I don't know about that. I mean, he'd probably do it if he could, but I don't know.
I think he would, yes.
Speaking of Xenoblade, though, another one of my favorite gaming couples is from the original Xenoblade Chronicles, and that would be Shulk and Fiora. Again, huge spoilers are coming. This relationship is a sad one. Officially, Shulk and Fiora were not a couple. They were just friends, but you can certainly feel that spark of romance between them at the beginning of the game. And, you know, they established this really, really good rapport between those characters, as well as Ryan. You know, it's just this really good, friendship with a spark of romance in it. And then the bad guys invade, everything goes upside down, and Fiora gets killed off. And it is shocking. It's one of the most shocking events in RPG that I remember seeing. I'm like, wow, we just spent a few hours establishing these characters really, really well, and then they just have her killed off. But then there's another twist, and they bring her back as a cyborg. And, you know, I imagine, you know, having a romantic relationship with a cyborg is going to prove somewhat difficult. But still, Shulk really, really cares about Fiora, even though she's, you know, been turned into, like, sort of a robotic freak. And you can really feel, you know, the connection that they share. And I feel like it's really, really meaningful. So I really love the way that all plays out, you know. Are you even a human anymore? No, not really. But, you know, I still care about you. And that's pretty cool. Continuing with character relationships in RPGs, another one that I really liked that was also on Nintendo Wii was Zale and Lady Callista from The Last Story. And their story... no pun intended, is sort of an Aladdin-type one where Callista is the royalty who, you know, wants her freedom and she escapes from the castle and Zale sort of protects her from the guards. They're trying to bring her back. And meanwhile, he's this dreamer who's like, oh boy, I wish I lived in the castle and, you know, was wealthy and had all the power. Anyway, that's how they first meet. And it progresses from there. And there's this one really touching scene under the stars where they talk about their past and their dreams. And you can just feel them growing closer to one another. To me, it feels fairly natural and not at all forced. And I just really enjoy the way it plays out and the way they interact, even though they come from sort of, you know, different worlds. And it just worked really, really well for me. I know not everyone agrees with that, but for me, it worked great. And, I guess to complete the Operation Rainfall trio, I should bring up Pandora's Tower as well. And that whole game is based around the romance between the two main characters, Aeron, the character you play as, and Elena, who is your girlfriend, and she is cursed, and she is going to turn into a monster unless you save her. So that's why Aeron is going around to all of these towers that are full of monsters and defeating these beasts and solving these puzzles. And he literally has to use these chains to rip off pieces of monster flesh that you then feed to Elena in order to stop her from transforming into a hideous beast. Plus, you basically have like this affection meter that's based on how well you treat her, how often you talk to her, how much you let her help you out. How often you return to, you know, give her the monster flesh to stop her from transforming. And that influences the outcome of the game because there are multiple endings. I still haven't seen the best ending myself, but, you know, in the good endings, you know, they share the same fate. You know, the bad endings, I think, one or the other doesn't quite make it.
Well, that's how you know it's love, though, by having someone feed monster flesh.
That's right.
That's a great relationship based on trust.
It is. And it's also, you know, because it's so integral to the game, I think that's one of the reasons that I like that relationship so much. Any others you want to bring up, or should I keep going here?
You can keep going. You're on a roll here.
Another one that I really, really like, and again, spoiler alert, is Professor Layton and Claire from the third Professor Layton title, which was Professor Layton and the Unwound Future. And this is another tragic romance. Claire, I believe, was Layton's fiance, but she gets like caught up in this time travel experiment explosion. And, apparently she is dead from that. That all happens, you know, before the storyline of the game. But then years later, when the game is taking place, her sister shows up. And, you know, she's helping you unravel this time travel plot that's going on and involving, you know, all sorts of, fake shenanigans and things. But then, you know, after everything is settled and you solve the mysteries, then you discover that the sister that's been helping you out really is Claire. And it's really a great moment because you sort of go through the game proving that time travel is fake. And then it's like, no, time travel actually worked only in this one particular instance. And it brought Layton's lost love to this point But then after they reunite for one last moment, she has to return to her own time and Leighton loses her all over again. So it's kind of wonderful, but also really, really sad.
Wonderful and tragic at the same time.
Yeah, and you can really, really feel for those characters. That's the first time that you ever see Leighton without his hat. He takes his hat off, you know, as he is like, you know, weeping for his lost love. So, like, how can you not feel the emotional impact of that relationship there?
Oh, seriously, yeah.
I mean, of course, in subsequent games, he, like, takes off his hat and he has, like, a giant afro underneath. But this was the first time, and it was very emotionally impactful.
Those other times don't count.
And then I guess the last one that I would like to bring up as a personal favorite gaming couple would be Sir Arthur and Princess Prinprin from the Ghosts and Goblins series. And for me, this is arguably the hottest romance in video games. For one thing, there are scenes in this series where you see Arthur and the princess, and Arthur's just lounging around in his boxer shorts while they're hanging out. You know, then she gets kidnapped, he jumps into his armor, and he chases off after her right away. But, you know, that's got to be, you know, quite the trusting relationship where it's okay if you just hang out with the princess in your boxer shorts.
Sure, sure.
And then, at the end of the game, you know, when they find each other again, you know, it's kind of like what you were saying about Mario and Pauline, where, you know, they grab each other, and suddenly all these hearts just come, you know, shooting out of them, only, you know, much more passionately, I would say, than it was with Mario and Pauline. I mean, it's pretty much about as steamy as 8-bit platformers get.
And he had to go through all the difficulty of that game to get to
her. He did. Not just once, but twice.
Yeah, that's real love.
Yes, exactly. So for that reason, I am considering that one, you know, possibly the hottest romance in video games.
What about Pac-Man and Ms. Pac-Man?
You know, I don't know a whole lot about them. I mean, obviously, they are a very loving couple. I don't have any disagreement about that. But
their relationship resulted in Baby Pac-Man, too.
This is true. This
or at least the popularity of the Pac-Man license necessitated offshoots that, created those characters.
Mm-hmm. This kind of makes me wonder again about Bowser. who is the mother of all of Bowser's kids? I mean, obviously, Nintendo was backpedaled on the Koopalings, and now they're like, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. They're not really Bowser's kids. At least that's what we're telling his lawyer, ha, ha, ha. But we know that Bowser Jr. is his kid, if nothing else, but we still don't know who the mother is to this day.
That's true. That's for a future game. Clearly, they're holding that.
Hopefully, someday we will get to the bottom of that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, if you don't have any more items for this list, I think that does it for this week's big topic.
That sounds good to me. I'm all tapped out.
And that being the case, I suppose it's time to wrap up this week's episode of the podcast.
But don't we have time for something more?
You know, I believe we do. And that is, of course, a dramatic reading. And once again, this is from the pages of Nintendo Power Magazine, Volume 1. And just like last week, this is a reader-submitted review, more or less. This time, of the NES game Legend of Kage. If you're like I am, that is, crazy about martial arts, The Legend of Kage is the game for you. I don't see how they get all this fun and adventure on one game pack. In the game, you are Kage, a young ninja warrior with one dangerous task, to save the Shogun's daughter, Princess Kiri, from the clutches of the evil warlord Yuhi. On your journey, you will encounter evil ninjas, fire-breathing monks, and even Yuki's right-hand man, Yoshi. You are armed with two weapons, your ninja sword and a limitless supply of star knives that can be hurled at your opponents like stones. If you wish to be reunited with your beloved Kiri, you must prevail. Sound fun? Think you have what it takes? Purchase The Legend of Kage, a game which you will treasure.
Sounds like a few companies hired that kid to write their back of the box copy later on.
Who knows? Maybe they did. Maybe went on to a wonderful career in marketing.
Very possible.
I don't know. And I didn't know that Yoshi was up to, you know, such naughty stuff before he joined up with Mario. Didn't know he was an evil ninja's warlord's right-hand man.
That's right.
Not sure about, you know, throwing ninja stars like stones, though. That seems like a recipe for disaster.
That's true. That's dangerous. Yeah.
That sounds a little troublesome. I didn't know that's how you were supposed to do it. Maybe I've been doing it wrong all these years.
Yep.
I don't know. Anyway, that does it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can follow me, The Hoff, on Twitter at Chris The Hoff, and you can find CJ at SuperPack, with a C. You can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com, and if you like the podcast, it would be great if you told your friends about us. Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Chris Johnston,
keep playing it loud,
and our psychotic overlord, Zant, we will see you next time.